Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Newsmakers from America and around the world speak with journalists in an unscripted and unrehearsed discussion about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. Here is your host on this edition of Press Conference USA, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Sarah Williams, co-host of VOA's China Focus. Our topic on this edition of the program is U.S. East Asia policy. Our guest, Alan Romberg. He's a distinguished fellow and director of the East Asia Program at the Stimson Center, that's a nonprofit policy institute here in Washington. Before joining Stimson, Alan Romberg spent almost 10 years as Senior Fellow for Asian Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and has worked 27 years in the State Department with over 20 years as a U.S. Foreign Service officer. He was posted overseas in Hong Kong and Taiwan. Alan also served in numerous senior positions where he dealt with East Asian affairs, including as staff member at the National Security Council for China and director of the Office of Japanese Affairs at the State Department. We are speaking with Alan just as the United States and China concluded the sixth round of the U.S.-China Strategic and Economic Dialogue in Beijing, where senior officials from both countries addressed issues ranging from climate change, cybersecurity, economic reforms, and diplomatic tensions with China's neighbors. And Alan Romberg joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much. Good to be here.
And I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, Sarah Williams.
Glad to be here, Carol.
Well, Alan Romberg, first, let's look at the overall U.S. policy toward East Asia. There was the so-called pivot or rebalance to Asia. It was supposed to have taken place. But in the meantime, there have been a lot of other intervening problems in other geographic areas, whether it's the deteriorating situation in Syria or Iraq, tensions between Ukraine and Russia, and of course the recent outbreak of violence between Hamas and Israel. These have all taken the United States' attention. And of course, with respect to China, we've seen it assert itself in the East and South China Seas to the dismay of its neighbors. So what is, in your view, the state of play between the world's two largest economies given these tensions?
Well, I think, first of all, the problems you cite and the fact that there are things happening all over the world is the way life is these days. And I don't think anybody could safely assume you can focus on one area and just ignore another. And indeed, I think when the rebalancing policy was first formally announced, there was a problem in that the way it was announced suggested we were pivoting away from Europe and pivoting away from the Middle East when there was never any such intention. So that they focused more on the term rebalancing. And I think it was a fundamental statement of policy, which is that our economic interests, our security interests, our diplomatic interests are, and for the foreseeable future, which is a very long time, going to be importantly centered in East Asia. So I think that the purpose of the policy was to make recognition of this and to make it clear that we were there to stay. It wasn't that we had left. I think that some of the people in the Bush administration have complained that the way it's been articulated by President Obama and his colleagues suggest that the U.S. somehow had left Asia. I don't think that's the implication. But as you say, resources, human and other, are scarce. And so I think the whole point of this was to make clear that there were some fundamentals that the U.S. was going to pay attention to and stick with. I think that the problems that we see only emphasize the importance of the relationship with China and with the region. It would be highly unusual if we didn't have these problems. China and the United States, for example, are two big countries. Japan is another. Korea is a major country in the region, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that the state of the relationship between the U.S. and China is okay. I think it's troubled. There are a lot of issues where we need to manage the issues better. And the point of the strategic and economic dialogue, in part, is to try to broaden that agenda and to deal with it successfully.
The United States does want to give more priority to East Asia. The officials go out of their way, such as Secretary of State John Kerry, saying that we are not trying to contain China. But it seems that China perceives it differently, that they see the U.S. stepping up its action in the region as a way to counter it. Can you see it that way from the Chinese point of view? Do you think that there are ways somehow that they will ever perceive it differently?
I can't answer the question how they're going to see it. I know that they see encirclement, I think, is perhaps a better term to use here than containment, because containment always refers to the Cold War. And as I've said, if we're trying to contain China, we're certainly going about it in a very strange way. Opening our markets, welcoming China into the world community in a variety of ways, not just to obey rules, but to help set rules and so on. Clearly, many Chinese see the U.S. seeking to limit China's rise. There's no question about that. And I think they're wrong. The U.S. feels very strongly and properly that China, that is strong, stable, prosperous, is an important contributor to world peace and stability. Now, strong doesn't mean so they can strong-arm their way around. But it does mean that a China that would be weak, divided, threatened, would be a very destabilizing force.
Well, this week, President Obama spoke by phone with Chinese President Xi, and he said that he wanted more cooperation and better handling of disagreements with China. Does this phone conversation, the fact that it follows last week's talks, could it indicate that perhaps the White House feels last week's dialogues between the U.S. and China were maybe less than successful at going over some of the problems in this relationship?
Well, it certainly didn't resolve all the issues, and a couple of the big ones in particular are not on the table at the moment through that vehicle, that is the cybersecurity issue and the bigger problems in the South China Sea. I don't think that the phone call indicates a failure to achieve what the SNED was intended to do. It is a very broad-gauged meeting with many members of the cabinet from both countries, very senior representatives representing their presidents, not just their formal positions in government and so on. It's an effort to try to advance the relationship across a broad spectrum of issues. But it didn't create new momentum, I would argue, in a fundamental way. And I think that, in my view, the presidents, following the lead of the cabinet members, the secretaries and ministers and so on, need to really engage personally on this. And so I am in strong favor of more interaction between President Obama and President Xi, and I hope that there will be a repeat of the so-called Sunnyland Summit in California last year in China this coming fall.
By shifting it to China, having a meeting like that in China itself, how could that advance relations between the two leaders? Could it?
Well, I hope so, but I don't think we should be unrealistic about it. The whole point, of course, is that the first meeting was in the United States, and appropriately, the second meeting would be in China. I believe that even though you don't expect two leaders to sit down and resolve all the specific issues, it's important that they understand where the other guy is coming from. What are his problems? What are his hopes? What does he want from you? What does he want you not to do? And why? As you filter the actions of the other side, the words of the other side, you can have perhaps a better insight into what's really going on. And you also have a way of communicating with that person as need be in the coming months and years.
You had just mentioned cybersecurity. How big a dispute is this issue of cyber hacking? Now, both countries are accusing the other of doing this. But in the bilateral relationship, how significant a problem is this?
I think at the moment it certainly is a very significant problem because of the indictment of the five PLA members by the United States for hacking. A fundamental issue for the U.S. is the hacking that's going on is in the commercial area. And it is suggested by the experts in the government that this information is then used to commercial advantage by Chinese firms. The U.S. has tried to make very clear it doesn't engage in that sort of hacking. I've heard senior intelligence officials in the United States say, of course we all try to get more information about the other guy. That's part of the business of maintaining stability, among other things. But we do not try to steal commercial secrets and pass them on to American firms. So from an American point of view, that's a fundamental difference. Chinese don't find that as persuasive as the American side does.
Yeah, and then there's, of course, the whole issue of former CIA contractor Edward Snowden, which the Chinese have discussed a lot about, the NSA, National Security Administration, spying, basically, on a number of people around the world.
Yeah, again, I think that the point is that from an American perspective, the U.S. is doing information gathering, however you want to characterize it, for national interest reasons and not for commercial exploitation reasons.
I think that's a very good way to distinguish the two. Well, Alan Romberg, I want to go from cyber spying or cyber espionage to the dispute in the South China Sea, another point of contention between the United States and China, and of course between China and its Southeast Asian neighbors. Do you see any movement in that direction? We know that China has really asserted itself in the South China Sea to the chagrin, of course, of the Philippines, Vietnam. There's been talk of development of a code of conduct to govern the waters. Are we any closer to a resolution on this dispute?
I don't think we're closer to resolution, but I hope we may be closer to managing it better. I haven't read the details, frankly, but I understand that the U.S. has put forth a proposal for freezing all activity on these various rocks, shoals, whatever you might have, by everybody. And one of the Chinese accusations is that the U.S. always takes the side of the other guy and is always criticizing China. Partly it's because, as you just suggested, the Chinese are acting in a much more assertive way than the others have been. But I do think that the U.S. needs to demonstrate that it really is even-handed in the sense that it takes no position on the competing territorial claims, and that its point is the maritime claims need to be based on territory, and if there is no resolution of the territorial claims, then people need to behave in a way which maximizes the possibility of managing these disputes peacefully. I don't think that we're going to see a quick resolution. From the U.S. point of view, the big thing that it had asked previously, and which it still would like to see, is China to define what's called the nine-dash line that takes up pretty much the entire South China Sea. It was a line that was drawn by the nationalist Republic of China government in the 1940s, but it's a dashed line which leaves vague whether it's claiming the territory within the line, whether it's claiming the water within the line, and the U.S. position has not been, you may not claim this, you may not do that. It's first, explain to us what it is. And second, to urge China to behave in a way which is not perceived as assertive.
Or unilateral.
Certainly unilateral. The Chinese, of course, say, well, everybody else is doing it too, and we're only responding to protect our own rights and interests. So it's not a one-sided story. But clearly, China as a huge player and power is perceived in a more threatening mode than a country which doesn't have those attributes.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Alan Romberg. He's a distinguished fellow and director of the East Asia Program at the Stimson Center. That's a Washington-based think tank. And I'm Carol Castiel, along with Sarah Williams, co-host of VOA's China Focus. This is a reminder that Press Conference USA is also available online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. And also, we love to hear from you. Please send your feedback on guests and topics to PCUSA@voanews.com. And we also have a fan page on Facebook. So check it out and like us at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA. Post a comment. Tell us where you're from and how you listen to the program. Here's a shout-out to loyal Nigerian listener Ibrahim Oyekanmi.
Mr. Romberg, among the growing tensions in the East and South China Seas, countries that are, you know, China's neighbors have complained about the territorial disputes with Beijing, and they're wary of what they see as China's growing military might. But meanwhile, is the U.S. working to establish closer military relations with some of those countries?
Right. Well, I think that the U.S. concern is that China not simply push its way around because it is bigger. It is modernizing its military in a very impressive way. It isn't necessarily making an accusation, first of all, on what rights people have. As I said before, the U.S. is absolutely neutral on who owns what piece of turf. That's not our business. What is our business is trying to maintain peace and stability, not just for freedom of navigation purposes, but for general regional concerns. I think that you will see that the countries in the region want a greater U.S. presence and greater U.S. role. They don't want bad relations with China, and they really don't want a U.S.-China confrontation either. But they do want a sense of backing that they're not just going to be subject to what they might see as the whims or pressures coming out of China. So one should not be surprised that those countries are seeking a more robust U.S. role, even though it does lead to claims by China that we're taking sides and that we're somehow interfering.
Meanwhile, a new poll conducted by the Pew Research Center says many Asian countries are worried that China's territorial claims could lead to war. And last week, Chinese President Xi said that confrontation between the U.S. and China would be a disaster. But what if, say, China engaged militarily against one of its Asian neighbors? What would the U.S. do in that situation?
First of all, I don't think China is going to do that. They've been very careful so far, even though they may have the PLA Navy over the horizon, to use their Coast Guard and their other civilian agencies to pursue their claims and to chase others away when they feel that that's a necessary thing to do, as in the recent dust-up with Vietnam. I think they're trying to be very careful. They don't want a war. Nobody wants a war. And I think that President Xi's call for avoiding a disaster is quite consistent with what he's been saying for a couple of years now. The whole purpose behind China's initiative for a new model of major power relations starts with the idea that you want to avoid confrontation between a rising power and an established power. Now, that requires some careful management by everybody concerned, and one of the concerns that the U.S. and others have is that China is not being as careful in managing it as would be necessary and appropriate.
Well, speaking of which, we talked about the tensions in the South China Sea, but there's also tension in the East China Sea. We note that in November 2013, China provoked Japan by declaring an air defense identification zone in the Pacific Islands. In China, they're known as Diaoyu, and of course, Japan, Senkaku. There, we have a China looking as if it is provoking Japan and looking to pick a fight. In the meantime, of course, the United States does go out of its way to say we are neutral on this. But at the same time, Japan is one of its very important allies, and we have an obligation to come to Japan's defense should it be perceived as being attacked. How do you see the situation today?
As you say, complicated. First of all, I think China's argument is that Japan provoked the problem by having purchased three of the five islands from a private Japanese owner. The Japanese government argument is that this was unrelated to the question of sovereignty, that the private owners of the islands wanted to sell them, that the very nationalistic governor of Tokyo was in the business of raising funds to buy them and then perhaps to take some very provocative steps, building a lighthouse, putting a pier facility, and so on and so forth. And then the central government, which, by the way, was the administration before Mr. Abe from the other party,
yes,
they felt that they had no other way to stop him than by purchasing them. I will say the Japanese press and everybody else in the world calls this nationalization. Japanese government has been careful not to say it's nationalization. But in any case, obviously China felt provoked. They felt that this was a violation of an agreement that had been reached 40 years before, and they decided that they would change the status quo. Status quo was that Japan had administrative control and that they really sort of controlled the fishing boats in the area and so on. So what China started to do was send in fishing administration and other oceanographic civilian agency ships patrolling inside the 12 nautical mile territorial waters. That led to a lot of tension. But of course, as I say, China says this is because Japan provoked this by violating a previous agreement. I think that both sides in this dispute are trying to avoid, again, ending up in conflict. And as you say, the U.S. is neutral on the ownership issue. But it did, with the reversion of Okinawa to Japan in 1972, include administrative control of these islands being returned to Japan. And so under the treaty, we do have an obligation to come to Japan's aid if those islands are attacked. Now, I'm sure nobody wants to fight a war over those islands, and I can't imagine that anybody will purposely take action to provoke a war. And President Obama was very clear about this when he visited the region a few months ago in saying nobody should provoke a crisis in the region.
Another issue in the area is Korea. And looking at North Korea and South Korea, President Xi just recently was in South Korea, and there were press reports saying that he and South Korean President Park Geun-hye seemed to be getting along quite well, and they were, you know, and for years, China has been North Korea's really only ally. How does the situation on the Korean Peninsula impact relations really between China and the U.S.?
There was a time in the past when I think one could say that cooperation on North Korea was sort of the poster child of cooperation between the U.S. and China. The fact of the matter is that the U.S. has been frustrated, however, that China has not exercised more of the leverage that it does have. And China doesn't really want to do that, not just because it has a perhaps the remnant of a formal treaty alliance with North Korea, but because it doesn't want instability on the peninsula. It doesn't want war. And it feels if the situation deteriorated, if there were tensions, it could lead to war. And the end result could be to China's strategic disadvantage. That is to say, if there were a war that led to unification, first of all, the war itself would be potentially extremely damaging to everybody's interests. Second of all, if it led to unification under South Korean aegis allied to the United States, the possibility is if nobody talked about the rules of the road beforehand, that this would somehow strategically disadvantage China. My sense is today what we have with China is a commitment to denuclearization, but an unwillingness to take steps that would potentially destabilize the North Korean regime, even though I think China is very upset with the way the North Korean regime is behaving.
Does that have something to do with the fact that he went to Seoul? And what message was President Xi sending when he just recently visited South Korea? Was he trying to drive a wedge between Japan and South Korea? How do you read that trip?
Yes. I think he was trying to do a lot of things. The most notable thing, first of all, China has a major interest with South Korea, including a very rapidly growing economic interest, and they've committed to try to negotiate a bilateral free trade agreement by the end of this year, which is a big deal. Second of all, the fact that he went to South Korea without an appropriate counterpoint, either a visit one way or the other with North Korea, is something everybody's taken note of, and I think they should. Again, I don't think that China wants to break with North Korea. I don't think it wants to destabilize North Korea. But Xi Jinping seems to have a lower degree of patience with coddling North Korea in every way possible than perhaps his predecessor did. And also, there is a new kid in town in Pyongyang. Kim Jong-un has acted in ways that people see as perhaps less predictable and potentially more provocative than his father or his grandfather. So I think that Xi would have liked to have driven a wedge between South Korea and Japan. President Park really didn't rise to the bait on that. Even though there's a lot of tension between Seoul and Tokyo, Xi resisted doing that, and I think Xi deserves to be commended for doing that because of the hard feelings that still exist all these decades later coming from the colonial period at the beginning of the 20th century.
Let's look at some of the economic issues. Certainly the economic relations between the U.S. and China are so significant. Did the recent talks last week, do you think those were strengthened by some of their discussions?
Well, I think there's a variety of fora in which these economic relations are being handled. I have to say, I haven't tried to dig into the specifics of what may have come out economically from those talks, but clearly both sides attach great importance to that economic relationship, as well, I must say, to the rest of the relationship. But as you suggest, this has grown by leaps and bounds over the years, and from being almost nothing at the beginning of the normalization process at the end of the 60s and in the 70s, it now is one of the most significant economic relationships in the world. And of course, China's economic ties with its neighbors, despite the political tensions we were talking about, are also extremely important, probably in relative terms more important to the neighbors, but they're also important to China. So China is, I think, trying on the one hand to protect its political interests, its territorial claims, etc., but it really is also, I think, very strongly trying to pursue stronger economic relations both with its neighbors and specifically with the United States. And I would expect to see that continue to grow.
And Alan, with regard to the U.S.-China relationship, Secretary Kerry said that the United States and China are committed to a new model of relations based on practical cooperation, but also constructive management of differences. Is that how you would characterize it? And if you were, again, advising the administration or the one that may come after the Obama administration, as we're in the waning days, how would you advise the U.S.?
I think that's a fair characterization. Keep in mind that that also is sort of a play off of Xi Jinping's formulation about a new model of major power relations. The three headlines of that relationship from the Chinese perspective were no confrontation, a win-win situation, and mutual respect. Now, when you dig down into the Chinese position, what they also want mutual respect to mean, for example, is mutual respect for core interests and major concerns. And that's where the U.S. says, now, wait a minute, what you consider a core interest and a major concern, first of all, isn't entirely clear, seems to be a moving definition. But second of all, we have differences over some of those issues, and we're not going to commit simply to saying, well, you claim it as a core interest, therefore you can have it your way. But I do think that the way that Secretary Kerry described it, and I think the headline of new model of major power relationship is a useful one. And I think Secretary Kerry did a useful takeoff on that, which I don't think the Chinese would disagree with, but I think they would also look for us perhaps to buy more into their definition.
Briefly, before we close, with regard to buying more into their definition, perhaps other analysts might say that the Chinese say this, they want a constructive relationship, a model of relations based on practical cooperation and so forth, but others see them as sort of aligning themselves often with rogue regimes or revisionist regimes or disruptive actors, perhaps like with Russia vis-a-vis its attitude in Syria and Ukraine now. How about that discrepancy between its words and its actual actions?
Well, of course, those were Secretary Kerry's words. And I think that what the U.S. would like to do is to shape that new model of relationship in the direction that he was outlining. Does that mean that China will buy into it? Not necessarily. You've pointed out some of the problems that exist with that. But I do think that this new model is very important to both countries. This is not just an ordinary relationship in that sense. The U.S. and China can't resolve all the problems alone. But I would argue that for so many of the world's problems, if we don't cooperate, they can't be resolved at all. So we need it for ourselves and each other. We need it for regional peace and stability and prosperity. And it's going to be tough work. We are different countries. We have different interests. We have different histories, cultures, political systems. That's what they get paid those big bucks for in trying to resolve those issues or manage those issues. I think they're quite sincere on both sides of wanting to have a new model of relationship. We have to find our way forward between the various definitions that we're working with, though.
Indeed, a very delicate balancing act. Alan Romberg is a distinguished fellow and director of the East Asia Program at the Stimson Center, a nonprofit policy institute here in Washington. Alan, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your terrific insights.
My pleasure.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Joe Gill. And joining me on the program was Sarah Williams, co-host of VOA's China Focus. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. From Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Press Conference USA. You can email your questions or comments about this edition of Press Conference USA to pcusa@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune to the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us again next week when another newsmaker speaks with journalists about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. We'll see you next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.